Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 227 of Registry Matters. Good evening, Saturday night. Oh, God, I screwed that all up. Happy Saturday night. How are you, sir?
I'm doing awesome. Thank you for inviting me.
I went down the whole roster of the 47 people that I do have available, and none of them were, so I was stuck back at you again.
That's really sad.
It is pretty sad. We're spending money in Ukraine. Any current politics stuff that you want to talk about, or world events, anything before we dive in?
I wanted to do a special segment on the economy and politics and how the economy becomes very political. And I was going to dive back about 60 years with some clips, but I just wasn't able this past week to pull it all together for our clip service. So hopefully we can do that in the next week or so. But I want people to understand what they're going to be facing in this election cycle. And it's not anything new. It's been going on through the ages, really, since we've had television. So be looking forward to that.
Okay. So we'll release a Patreon extra, something that is 100% registry related about the economy.
Well, I'm not saying it's that, but it's political related. Once people understand the political process, they're more likely to be able to accomplish their objectives when they understand and accept how the process works. And we still get a lot of pushback. People tell me all the time that I don't understand. This is not the way it should be. And you know what I have. You can go ahead and finish what I say in response to that.
It's the way it is.
That is correct. We haven't done that for a while.
We have not. So, you know, just let's talk about that for just a minute. If you want a roundabout near your neighborhood, if you want a sidewalk, like all of this stuff goes through some kind of political process, correct? Even if it's at the city council or whoever makes roads and sidewalks.
That would be correct.
So if the teachings here, quote unquote teachings that I'm using in air quotes that my camera was on, I'm doing air quotes now. The political process, the things that we talk about here, apply to us as individual citizens in this country. We can shape our little communities as we want to, going against whatever somebody else wants as well. I mean, if somebody else doesn't want the sidewalk and they get enough people to vote against it, then you don't get your sidewalk. But that's how the process works.
We are in control of our destiny in this country, and that is such a gift and so misunderstood. People act as if these things are foisted upon them from powers beyond us, and they're not. Our government is a direct reflection of us.
Yeah. All right. And did you want to publicly say what you're up to tomorrow?
I'm going to be doing something I've been doing practically every week for the last 3 months on Sundays. I'm going out and doing some campaigning for a candidate for the state legislature. And it's an investment in the process. There are a number of ways that you have influence. One of them is to make large donations, and I don't do that. I do make small, moderate donations from time to time. But another way is to impress them with your knowledge and understanding of the process and help them navigate the process that they're up against to be elected. And amazingly, you'll have an open door. But folks, this would mean you would have to give up your USFL. There's a new league of football.
There is. It's run by The Rock, isn't it?
I'm not sure, but that would mean that you would have to divest of a Sunday activity or a weekend activity. It wouldn't have to be Sunday, but a lot of campaigning is done on weekends because that's when you find people more likely to be at home. But that's an investment I'm making so that I will be able to have access in the event this candidate wins. In the event this candidate doesn't win, then I will begin to invest in the winner so that I have access, but I'll invest in a different way.
Crazy Ivan says, that's what a DVR is for, so that you can record the game, or in your case, that's a Betamax. You remember Betamax?
Oh, I do. That was a great machine. I've got one still that I use to this very day.
Do you know why Betamax lost out to VHS?
Because they were better.
No, because they could record longer than an hour. A Betamax tape could only go for an hour, and so you couldn't record like a television show with it. So you had to cut it back, and you would have to use multiple tapes on a Betamax. At least that's my understanding. I could be wrong.
Oh, I didn't ever hear that. But if you say so.
All right, well, then tell me what we have going on tonight after we've BS'd around for 5 minutes.
We're going to be talking about a lawsuit filed in California against the U.S. Attorney General. Diving into that, we're going to be talking about a recent U.S. Supreme Court decision that is tangentially related to our issue. And you're greatly consternated. You said you read that 2 or 3 times. I've never known you to read.
I did.
Why did you read it so many times?
Because there are big words in there. If the word has more than 5 or so letters, I'm done.
So, well, anyway, we're going to be talking about that. And we've got a couple of comments. I think there was a question that held over from the last episode we didn't cover. If we have time, we may get to that written question.
Yes.
And we've got a plethora of articles, and we may get to some of those, depending on how long you rant.
Because I have a little bit of a rant that I want to go through.
You have a rant, and then we're going to reannounce my engagement because no one, they're very disappointed, no one recognized my fiance, and that's not acceptable.
I'm not surprised by this. I'm not surprised by this, Larry.
So
I have no idea who this person is. I still don't even after you've told me who it is, I still don't know who it is. I think you're lying to me.
So, all right, if you say so.
All right, well, let's dive right in. Let's do this question number one. This one is for this episode. At least that's the way that it is named. It says, "Dear Narsal," I always want to have like some little like foo-foo-y music, like "Dear Abby" or something like that. I'm writing to obtain information pertaining to 290 registrant laws. I have what is 290 registrant laws? What does that mean?
That's the section of the California Code.
Okay. God, that's not written very well. I understand California is the strictest in the country. I repeatedly asked the prison officials about this, and they won't tell me anything. It's likely they want me to go out totally blind. I understand there are residency requirements where that place can be, lie detector mandates, along with a plethora of other stuff, all which I know absolutely nothing about. I understand that you are an organization that explains this stuff to us. I want to make sure that I'm educated before I hit the streets. Unfortunately, this person is not willing to help with anything related to a 290. In fact, I have repeatedly, over the years, written our CRM, which is Community Resource Manager, asking if they can bring PFR groups into the prison. And I am over and over again told, no. It's really a difficult thing to swallow. I am one of the ones who have learned from my mistakes, want to correct those mistakes, and want to help spread the word to those who want to do the same thing. I hope that you can help me, and I look forward to hearing from you soon. Thank you in advance for your assistance.
Well, that was from Craig in Stockton, California. We did send, FYP sends to people the basic registry requirements as they are presented by the Class Kids Foundation. So we sent that to him, and we also let him know that we're going to answer this on the podcast. And the answer is that I think he's convoluting two things about the polygraphs. That's not a requirement of 290, to my understanding. That's not in the registry law. So it sounds like he's going to be under some community supervision of some type, and those are disconnected. Whatever community supervision imposes on you that may have come through the court, or it may be a condition that they impose themselves, that's not related to the registry. The registry is really okay. Much more straightforward, and somehow or another that gets confusing for people. So you're going to have the registry Correct. Requirements, and you're going to have your supervision requirements. And there are some overlap. Some registries have proximity restrictions within the registration law, and some don't, but they're imposed by the supervising authorities, and they go through that with you when they put you on supervision. And you can always tell them those requirements are not acceptable. Right?
You can tell them that so you I would like to go back. Is that what you're saying?
Well, when they hand you your conditions, for example, if they're going to parole you, they're going to give you a certificate of parole, and you're going to read the conditions and exchange for a certificate. When they present you those conditions, you can tell them that you found them unacceptable, and they won't give you a certificate of parole.
Okay.
So, but you do have a choice. You would leave the prison at some point, unless you had lifetime parole, but unless you had if you had some shorter period of time, you'd be leaving prison with just registration requirements. Then you'd be looking specific at the requirements in Section 290. And those are different.
So we have a comment in chat, though, that I think is also useful. The prison staff are not the ones that know about these requirements anyway, and they're not really designed to deal with it. They're just designed with the confinement side of it. It's not really that they're not willing to help, even though that's probably part of it, but it's just not really their jurisdiction either.
That's a great point. It would be ideal if the prison staff did have more information on this, but they don't. They're more focused on other aspects of reentry, making sure that you meet the requirements. And the registry is not generally something, at least in my state, they don't spend a lot of time. You find all that out when you get to your supervising officer. They tell you, go down and register within 24 or 48 hours, whatever the case may be. And you learn these things when you get out. Well, he wants to know. Now I'm going to pose a hypothetical question. Are you going to refuse to comply with them? So what I'm trying to get at is you have to do these things regardless of what they are, unless you're going to tell them to take it and shove it. So really, the registry requirements, they're really not relevant because you have to do them, or else if they truly are requirements of registration, they will violate you under the statute. And if they're requirements of supervision, they're going to try to violate you as a technical violation of your terms of supervision. You're going to have to do what they tell you.
Yeah, I'm with you. It doesn't matter what the requirements are. It's pretty much, yes, I will do them, provided they're not having you, I'll just say something stupid, run down the street naked. Like, that's not going to be one of the things to do, but they're going to tell you to live somewhere. They're going to tell you to do counseling. They're going to tell you to have a curfew. They're going to tell you those kinds of things. But they're not going to tell you to do something. Should I say they're not going to tell you to do something that's completely absurd, Larry, or is there something completely absurd that's out there that I'm kind of glossing over?
Yes, they're completely absurd things they'll tell you, but you have to do them even when they're absurd until a court says that you don't have to do them. They'll tell you in this state that you cannot have a storage unit. They'll tell you that you can't rent a hotel room without their permission.
Or you can't couldn't pick up a hitchhiker.
Yeah, well, that's in our behavioral contract here. You can't have a storage unit because you might be hiding things from your supervising officer. So therefore, they need to know about your storage unit. If they sit around with their small caseloads and call, which they have small caseloads here for PFR supervision, if they find that you've rented a storage unit, they will go get a warrant from the court, from their supervising judge, or from the if you're under parole, they'll get a directive that they search that unit, and they will find what you have hidden from them, and generally, they come up with something, and guess what? It holds up in court.
Are there any resources out there that describe these various conditions of supervision for people?
Well, in our state, we send a behavioral contract to people who ask for it. I don't know that all states have such an elaborate contract, but we send it out to people who request it for our state. It's very intense in terms of what they will impose on you, and there could be other things that's not in the contract that they may invent, but the contract is very, very thorough.
I see. Okay. I was wondering, there's a resource at NARSAL that may have some of this information. I'm not sure if that it's complete in that regard. I think that's more for the registry requirements and not so much for the supervision.
That is correct. They don't focus on the supervision side.
And that can also be kind of like the state requirements are going to be yours unless the judge added them. But the probation requirements, the supervision ones, could kind of be hit or miss depending on the person in the county.
It could be in the case of some states here, the supervision is more uniform because it's the state of New Mexico that supervises the people. You're in the Department of Corrections Probation Parole Division. So there's a very similar supervision regimen regardless of what county you're in.
Gotcha. Okay. Let's cover, if you don't mind, a couple comments that we have received over on our Patreon page. If you want to support the program, then you can go over to patreon.com/registrymatters or find the donate button over at fypeducation.org. The first one comes from Will, the episode we did a couple weeks ago where I built all that content about Roe versus Wade. He writes, the SOR standard should be left to the states in state cases. Overturning Roe kicks the issues back to the states. Why shouldn't the feds keep their noses out of state registries? And if you don't mind, Larry, if I take a first crack at this, don't we want some kind of minimum standard of what is acceptable and uniform across the country? whether that's some kind of motor vehicle requirements, some sort of bare minimum standard of what you would expect from people. And that's why they, the federal government doesn't necessarily mandate that your car have all four wheels operational, but then the state itself wouldn't receive funds if they don't require that your car have four functioning wheels.
That's a vague way of trying to get to the point I think you're trying to make.
So, perhaps, yes.
So the states, by and large, have abandoned their vehicle inspection regimens, at least the states I'm familiar with have. You know, you don't have to go in and do an inspection and get the sticker saying your car is safe anymore. But that doesn't end the federal control, because they do it further upstream in terms of vehicles. They control them in terms of production, because no one can argue that that's not interstate commerce. Vehicles are sold and transported across state lines. So the feds exert the bulk of their control in the design and development and manufacture and sale of vehicles that meet standards. Now, states like California go above those standards, right?
All right.
They impose a higher standard upon vehicles. And some other states in the more progressive leading states are mimicking what California does in terms of vehicle pollution. Particularly, they focus on the green gas, because of the global warming, and California's on fire most of the time. So I think that's what you're trying to get at. But they, in terms of the registry, the comment is a little bit disjointed, because what he's missing is that overturning Roe versus Wade is a almost 50-year precedent, where businesses have built up around providing these services to women. And I think it's largely women that get these services. Would you agree?
I'm not familiar with any men that have been required that have wanted an abortion.
but businesses have built up, and people are accustomed to this precedent. And I happen to know this person is a conservative, and he just wants so hard for the conservatives to be helping us. And he wants to find that magic bullet formula, but he misses the mark on this, because I will guarantee you he would do a magic flip-flop if the Supreme Court had decided in 1973 that registering people was unconstitutional. And here, 49 years later, if they were deciding to overturn a 49-year precedent that he liked, because he would like that precedent, would you agree with me on that?
I believe so.
Okay, but he would magically find a strong and strenuous objection, because he would say that he's moved on with his life. He would make all the arguments that we make, those of us who support a woman's right to choose. And I'm going to go ahead and say I do support that right. I haven't said it previously, but I believe that that right is something that I support, even though I think it was an invented right. We've had it for nearly 50 years, and I support that. He would magically be in favor of preserving. He would be a big proponent of stare decisis on that. He would say, how dare they overturn that? Yes. But on this particular one, he wants to make a flawed analogy, because there's no analogy. There's no 50-year precedent in place that says a PFR has a right to disappear like a you-know-what into the wind, and that registering them is unconstitutional. There was a decision made. It was 7-2 decision made in 1973 that a woman has that right to make that determination with her body. And like it or not, that was an interpretation that people have relied on for five decades.
Yep. In that draft release, they were referencing, how do you want to define which stare decisis time frame to use? Is 50 years not enough? Is 100 years the right range? Maybe it's 500 years? Like, think of the archaic things that existed as laws, like, I don't know, burning witches from the 1600s. Like, okay, do you want to use that as the standard for what was traditionally accepted as, like, common law? Like, that's what we know to be the fact of the world? So 50 years isn't enough? You have to go back that far? Okay, so we have to go live in some sort of barbaric times.
Well, it's deeper than that. This was, they've been fighting since 1973. To get to this point. Now, I still maintain optimism that they will not completely gut the Roe versus Wade decision, because that's not the case before them. The case before them is a statute of Mississippi that I believe cuts it off after 16 weeks. So I don't know how they can go beyond that because that's not before them. They don't have the Oklahoma law. They don't have the Texas law. They don't have a heartbeat law. They have Mississippi statute before them. So, right. So that will create a new standard that will give women fewer options. 16 weeks is still a pretty good time. I think most women know they're pregnant after 16 weeks. Again, I don't have personal experience, but I think you generally know you're pregnant after 16 weeks, right?
I think somewhere in the I'm way out of my league, but I think you definitely don't know after the first, you might not know in the first month because maybe you just missed your period. And then 8 weeks, now you have some clues and maybe things start changing and you start realizing this. Please feel free, any woman, if I'm completely off the mark, just throw tomatoes all you want. I'm like, it's more than that, but yes.
So, well, basically when we get down to what we think about the Supreme Court, here's where everybody is. If they can't win their point legislatively, they want to win it through the courts. Everybody's that way. And since 1973, there's been a concerted effort to overturn Roe. And a candidate for office in 2016 said, I will make that a litmus test for my appointments to the Supreme Court. And I'm assuming that that candidate kept his word and got those commitments, which was a very dangerous thing to do, to extract a commitment of how you vote. But apparently, those commitments may have been made. We will find out in about 3 weeks because the decision will be out by the end of June. So we'll soon know.
Right. All right. Well, moving over to another comment that we got from Dave. And just to put it out there, my criminal background checks come back clean. My adjudication was withheld. However, most background check companies also do a registry check. That's where they get the information. Remind me what it would mean by my adjudication was withheld.
I mean, it's some sort of, there's a variety of sentencing options that will actually not find, you'll do a factual stipulation and the person accused will make the concession that they did commit the offense, but they won't actually enter the finding of guilt and adjudication of guilt. And generally I hear that word more when it refers to juvenile adjudication. So he may be talking about a juvenile adjudication, but you could also have adjudication withheld in the adult courts. So it means that you stipulated that you did this, and after a period of time, they'll dismiss it without a formal finding of guilt. So therefore, you've never been found guilty of a felony, but many of those states that have that adjudication withheld, they have a carve-out that says you will still register because factually you did the sex offense, you admitted that you did it, therefore you have to register. Florida's one of those states that does that, and there are others.
All right. Anything else on this? I mean, if you end up on the registry, like you're going to end up on somebody's radar because they're going to do the double search.
That is correct. So what the point he's probably making is that it kind of defeats the whole plea. His attorney would have been telling him, man, you got this great of plea. You're not going to have a conviction. Sure. You know, this, when you complete your probation, this is going to go away. And the attorney either didn't know or chose not to tell him, but the registry is going to be a clawback because the registry, in order to register you, they're not going to say they're registering you for thin air because you're bored and you wanted to come down and sign up. They're going to put that you committed a sexual offense on the registry, which is going to neuter your deferred adjudication.
I think I understand. Okay. Let's move along, Larry. You can sit back for a few moments, and I'm going to read something that I prepared kind of like off the cuff. But we're going to call this Andy's Rant. All right?
Go for it.
All right. Well, Larry, I wanted to get your input. So when I'm done with this, feel free, you know, hold back until I'm done. And I wanted to get your input regarding amendments and textualism. Let's use the First Amendment for this example. Let's pretend that we're releasing the latest episode of Registry Matters. We are currently about 1,500 miles apart. I think that's right. Do you think that's about right?
Close enough, yes.
Okay. We are each in our respective offices. I'm using my latest badass computer, and you're using your latest and greatest computer that was released in the late 1990s. We are connected over Zoom using a fantastic product that Al Gore created called the Internet, and we are recording this episode on June 4th. How much does this cost us to do this? Outside of the original expenses and the ongoing time expenses, it's practically free for us to create, produce, and distribute this product. We take the final product and run it through a couple iterations of edits to release the transcript as well. We print it in-house, print the envelopes, fold and stuff them. 24 hours after it's released to patrons is when the transcript comes out. They're in the mail, headed to subscribers in print format. What a great world it is. And it's a great world we live in that the First Amendment prevents the government from having this program where we are regularly very critical of our government. I think I worded that right. Let's change one thing in this scenario and how things would be different. Let's make the date June 4th, but not 2022, but let's make it 1794. Very near the date that you were born, Larry. What year were you born? I forget all the time.
1827.
Okay, so that's not far off. That's 30 or so years off. How would this change what we're doing? First of all, where would even you be living? New Mexico was created somewhere in the 1800s, I think, right?
1912.
Is that, oh God, okay, so like way off. So where would you even live if this weren't the case? This would be territory of Mexico, I guess. The scenario is also vastly different because of the cost to produce this. We couldn't even make the recording in the late 1700s. I guess we would have to change it to a show that we take on the road. We would perform in small theaters. We could ride our horses around the country to reach the audience interested in this program. The speed of a horse is, I think, Larry, maybe about 10 miles an hour on average over distance. In a given day, maybe we could move from DC to Richmond. That's probably even a stretch to go that far. Roads were near impossible to use the same way. We would have real threats from nature to contend with, weather, animals, just general survival would all come into play. We then move from Richmond on down to Raleigh. This would be another couple days for us to bring the program, Registry Matters, to the new audience. We could then deliver the week's news to this new location. Oh yeah, let's not forget about the transcript. We would have a scribe that we take with us and takes notes by hand to record what is said. And after a number of shows, our trusty scribe has complete enough notes to put together a weekly transcript. We take the transcript in written copy to the local printing press office for them to create the movable type and then run the whole copy process. The transcript is about 8 or so pages. If the printing press could create the transcript in a week, I'm thinking that we would be a speedy turnaround. And then we have several dozen copies, which we can make take another week. I'm speculating here. Could be vastly longer. The point I'm trying to make here is the world we lived in at the time of the adoption of the Bill of Rights, that world is vastly dissimilar to where we are today. It was crazy expensive to have speech at the time. Compared to now, it is essentially free to make and distribute speech. The shooter in Buffalo streamed his killing rampage onto YouTube. Last I heard, millions of people worldwide have seen the video. All that to say, I greatly appreciate what the idea behind the text is, but more and more the limits to the thinking that a textualist interpretation of the Constitution is very limited. The words that were written are taken into account the climate of the world at the time. In some circumstances, those conditions don't seem to have changed. How many times has the Third Amendment been challenged in a court compared to the First Amendment? Are you a free speech absolutist? Is it okay for anyone to say anything in any location or venue? The answer is no. You can't say certain things, even in public. The B word, and that's not like the four-letter word B, but it's another four-letter word B that you can't say in an airport or a movie theater. But are you a free speech abolitionist? Should all speech everywhere be regulated in public or private like that, as in the book 1984? Both scenarios frighten me greatly. A possible analogy that I'm trying to present is thinking of a balloon filling with air. If the environment in which it was written is the outside air pushing against the balloon, and the amendment itself is the balloon with the air inside, the two are arrows pointing at each other. Think of it as multiple forces at play in the writing of the amendment, and laws as well. There are pressures to the climate in which the text was written. In the case of the First Amendment, it was exorbitantly expensive to create speech. The government then didn't have a very high bar in stating the government shall create no law inhibiting speech. That was long before there was anything like the amount of distribution that exists in the internet where the normal cost of distribution is free. If 1, 10, or 1,000 more people were to download this show directly from Registry Matters CO or from YouTube, the cost to us is zero. So I just wanted to bring that up. I was listening to something that they were describing that the cost of speech was so high at the time that the government could make that kind of law or that kind of amendment. And the impact is certainly great, but you also didn't have this mass distribution network that we have now. What do you think?
Well, I get what you're saying, but again, the government is the one that's being prohibited from interfering. That amendment does not interfere with other parties. It was a control and check on the government's power to regulate speech.
I completely agree with you. Completely agree. And but so when like there's pushes to prevent like YouTube from taking down this video of the shooter. I don't remember if he streamed on YouTube or Facebook, whichever one doesn't really matter to me. And there may be legal challenges that they took them down because that is in inhibiting their speech, but it violates the terms of their service. Like this gets super murky. I just wanted to bring up that today's climate is vastly different on all kinds of things, not just First Amendment, not just Second Amendment. Like I said, I don't think anyone's ever challenged the Third Amendment. I've never heard anything. Shouldn't the climate that we live in, the world we live in, influence the way that we look at the text? Because the environment that the text was written in is not the world today.
Well, I would say yes, but the textualists don't say that. But again, this interference with taking down the video, this would be no different than in the 1960s and 70s and 80s when station management decided not to run the gory clip of what happened. They would edit it out on the cutting room floor and they would choose not to show it. That was their prerogative to do that. The government wasn't telling them to do that. They were deciding that their viewers weren't going to see that, and their viewers could always change to another channel, right?
Totally. I remember when they finally decided after 9/11 to stop showing the towers coming down. I was like, can we stop showing this, please? Like, I don't need to see this again, 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 again. They I think collectively all the general managers said, we're not going to show this anymore.
Well, and there was, I forget which network it was that had the original I Dream of Jeannie. They would not show her belly button.
Oh.
That was, if you look at all the episodes, you'll see that her belly button is covered. Because that was taboo, and I think it was CBS.
Sounds like it.
But
scandalous.
But they wouldn't do that. But that was not the government telling them to do that. That was their own, of their own volition. They made that decision. If you don't like what Facebook is doing, close your account. What do they call it when you close your account? You know, there's a term for it. But anyway, disable your Facebook account. And it's not that expensive to create an alternate platform. That's the beauty of capitalism, right?
That it is.
Well, the former president created
his... Until you move into... Yeah, no one's going to go there. No one's going to go there because he has 85 million followers on Twitter, and he's only going to get the echo chamber of people following him on his whatever liberty, truth, whatever the hell the thing is called. The magic is that he has the 85 million people that are listening to him, including me, on Twitter.
Well, I thought he was banned from Twitter. Is he back?
No, but the conversation comes up if Elon Musk does buy it, and he's more or less a First Amendment absolutist, then he would get his account back.
I see.
So anywho, all right. Are we done with this?
I think so.
All right.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app, hit the subscribe button, and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
Well, you people have put in this case recently filed by the Pacific Legal Foundation against the United States Attorney General. I've read the complaint, and it is AXOL, the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offender Laws. Is that what AXOL stands for? I always forget.
Yes.
That is the named plaintiff. Why doesn't NARSOL file cases with NARSOL being named as the plaintiff, Larry?
Well, actually, NARSOL doesn't do that. There's NARSOL versus Stein in North Carolina, but there are barriers in terms of organizational standing that must be overcome, and it opens the organization to intense scrutiny, especially of its membership list. AXOL noted in the complaint that it represents more than 100,000 members. The first discovery demand I would make would be for their member list if I were on the defense side of this case, because they asserted that they have 100,000 members. I'd say, okay, let's see your list.
Wow. Like, just for, like, I mean, how many, aren't there only like, are there 100,000 people on the registry in California?
That's what they're claiming as their membership.
Yeah, I got who they think they're representing, but they don't have that many people on their actual roster. Can't they avoid providing that?
Perhaps, but it would divert their resources from the underlying issue of the case, because they would have to pivot to arguing for an order of protection from the discovery demand. And so that's exactly if I don't have a law degree and I can think of that, trust me, they can think of that.
All right, we have to unpack this a bit, Larry. According to the complaint, more than 25 years ago, plaintiff John Doe pled no contest to a single misdemeanor count of sexual battery. When he was 23, he had a consensual but inappropriate encounter with a 16-year-old, which did not involve intercourse. His conviction required him to register as a PFR. Since then, Mr. Doe has dedicated himself to making amends and becoming a model citizen. He expressed sincere remorse for his crime and voluntarily underwent psychological treatment. And equipped with a healthier perspective, he pursued higher education and has had a rewarding and productive career, becoming a loving husband and father, became an active participant in his church. He has done everything anyone is supposed to do following a criminal conviction. Because of his remarkable rehabilitation, California courts expunged his conviction and issued a certificate of rehabilitation, which is a judicial recommendation for an unconditional pardon. He is no longer a convicted criminal and has not registered as a PFR for more than a decade. According to the Attorney General, in a new rule, registration requirements under the Sex Offender Registration and Notification Act, 86, blah, 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 blah. You can find it in the show notes. Mr. Doe is still a convicted PFR and must register under the federal SORNA. How? So he got pardoned and record expunged, and now they have dragged him back into the registry? How can this be?
Well, I find the complaint very interesting in that it does not actually allege that any entity has ordered Mr. Doe to register. It says, quote, on December 8th, 2021, DOJ, at the direction of Defendant Garland, issued the rule, registration requirements under the PFR Registration Act. The new rule became effective on January 7th, 2022. Under the new rule, despite his conviction having been expunged, Mr. Doe is required to re-register as a PFR in California. In addition, Mr. Doe is directed to provide all of the information required by the new rule to California authorities in person, but California has informed him that he cannot do so, and he's not considered a registrant under California law. That suggests to me that there has been no such directive issued, because they very carefully worded that. They didn't say that anybody has told him to register. This is their interpretation of what they think they see in the regulation. But go ahead. I'm sure you're going to have a comeback.
Yeah. Can the feds, I'm going to ask it this way, can the feds force them to register under the federal registry?
Well, I'm not sure that they can, but I'm not sure that they can in view of the Willman case out of the Sixth Circuit. Maybe they can. Even though the Adam Walsh Act was enacted more than 14 years ago, there's massive confusion as to whether or not Congress created a federal registry. We hear this regularly, and even the courts do not seem to understand there is no federal registry. There is a search engine operated by the federal government that looks into state registries, but that in and of itself is not a registry. Beyond that, it's very debatable if the federal government can create a federal registry for those convicted of violating only state laws. If you read the 93 pages in the regulations, the Attorney General acknowledges that, and they've acknowledged that ever since the passage of the AWA. This is precisely the reason federal strategy has been to strongly encourage the states to enhance their registries. The feds have provided enhanced federal funding for those states that substantially comply, and they have used the threat of potentially losing 10% of burn grants to encourage states to come on board.
You just delivered the biggest mumbo-jumbo word salad I can imagine. Can you not admit that the federal government is attempting to expand its jurisdiction?
Yes, I can admit that. And they have many times. But just because they're trying to do something, it doesn't necessarily mean that they can't succeed.
And you also seem to be forgetting that FYP Education has a massive archive of what you've said in the past. So I checked FYP's archive and found this quote. Narsal recognizes that there could be a federal registry for people who have federal convictions. That registry would involve anything that's a federal crime. Major crimes occurring in Native American territories end up in federal court, as do military convictions. And for those, there could conceivably be a federal registry. Such a registry would be separate from the state registries because there is no federal jurisdiction hook that could force a person with a state conviction to report to a federal registrar. Crimes occur when laws of specific states are broken, and each specific state must determine if any of those crimes trigger a requirement to register. Each state creates its own registry. A federal registry operating side by side with a state registry would be duplication of effort, and there would be no reason for one. I think you people wrote that. Do you still stand by?
Yes, I do. But just because there's no reason or justification for duplication does not mean that there can't be a federal registry. The question continues to be, how can the federal government gain the jurisdictional hook that it would need to have a federal registry?
If they did that, Larry, would that create a condition of double jeopardy? I bet you're going to say it's because of civil regulatory scheme, so it's not a double jeopardy condition.
That's what I would say, yes.
And you people also wrote this. Even though there are significant number of people prosecuted for violation of federal SORNA, that doesn't translate to there being an actual federal sexual offense registry. In the 14 years since the AWA became law, the feds have regularly asserted their jurisdiction to prosecute whenever there is a somewhat clear jurisdictional hook. This would include those who relocate from one jurisdiction to another, or those who choose to travel internationally because there is a federal requirement of at least 21 days notice in advance of any international travel. They have claimed federal jurisdiction under the Commerce Clause of the United States Constitution. The theory is when a registered person crosses jurisdictional boundaries, he or she has engaged in interstate commerce. It sounds to me like this person cannot register because the state of California will not accept his registration. Can the feds convict him for failure to do the impossible?
Well, no, they cannot force him to do the impossible. But at this point, it's not even clear to me that they, being the feds, have attempted to force him to do the impossible. At least I did not discern that from reading the complaint. There is not a danger, in my opinion. But since you're so big on FYP archives, may I remind you of something else I wrote in the same article that you're so fond of quoting today?
Sure. And if you think it will save you, feel free to quote yourself from what you said from the past.
Okay. I said in the same article that you seem to have dug out of our archives, the AG's proposal opens the door for the states to become federally compliant without adopting all the provisions through their legislative processes. A state can simply do it with a blanket amendment to their existing law that a person must comply with all federal registration requirements. For example, rather than the state prescribing how long a person has to register under state law, they could totally eliminate their state reference to how long a person registers and say instead the person must register consistent with the terms of registration established by the federal AWA. They could state that your reporting frequency will be consistent with the standards required by federal law. In some rare instances, this could benefit the offender because some states require more frequent reporting than actually required by the AWA. Shall I go on?
I do see that in the next paragraph of your writing, you said, this proposal does not create a new jurisdiction for the feds unless the states wants to. So if the state has strong advocates that beat back such changes, it won't change one iota of what is in the state's law. But Narsal's fear is that the state will gladly allow the feds to help them achieve AWA compliance. An example would be the 21-day advance notice of international travel, which is required by federal law. If your state has not included that in its requirements, there is no federal registrar to file the travel plans with, which means you cannot comply. This lack of notice limits the feds in their defense to prosecute those who fail to comply. Now, I think I see your fear.
Yes, and even before the AG's proposal, the state of West Virginia figured a way to implement the 21-day advance notice requirement. They sent letters, they being the state, West Virginia State Police, to all registrants in the state and demanded that they come in and sign an acknowledgement of the federal government's requirement. As far as I know, everyone, but I'm going to say most, voluntarily signed, despite the fact that the law of West Virginia did not at that time require such notice. Now, that they've signed, failure to file the required notice of travel can be successfully prosecuted by the feds in West Virginia. And I subsequently believe that West Virginia has now added that to their state law, that provision. But at the time that they sent the letters, it was not in the state law.
Did you tell me that there's like a legal term for this lack of knowledge?
Yes, that is the one that we use all the time. S-C-I-E-N-T-R. Scienter.
Scienter. Yes. Gotcha. Okay, good, 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 good. And what do you see as the downside to this case? I think I can see one of them.
Well, if Mr. Doe has not been ordered to register, this case is premature and speculative. Thus, it should be dismissed. If he has been ordered to register, and other than the general interpretation of the ABA regulations, there is considerable danger, even in a liberal, pointy-headed state like California.
I see. So what is the danger in all of that then?
Well, even in a liberal, pointy-headed state, remember what I said in my previous writing, that this proposal does not create a new jurisdiction for the feds unless the state wants it to. You remember that?
I think I do.
Okay. So, well, let's try to walk through this hypothetical. The complaint gets the attention of the press, and they seek comment from the Attorney General of California. The reporter will ask the question as follows. Do you think it's a good public policy for our state to have people who've committed serious sexual offenses living anonymously in the community? And then there's the likelihood that victim advocates will apply even more pressure to close the loophole that they will perceive that permits people to go on with their normal lives while the victims live in constant fear of being attacked again by their former perpetrator. Political pressure could easily mount, and the California Assembly could find itself in an impossible political position of telling the voters that the federal government has it all wrong on the PFR issue. Is that a sustainable political position?
I guess time will tell on that one, but I'm going to go with no, I think.
Yeah, that's my fear of this. I'm always thinking ahead of where this is likely to go. And if I've missed that in the complaint, I would encourage some of our gurus to read it, but I don't see a single assertion that anybody has directed him to register. This is, in my opinion, their interpretation of what they're wanting to do is to relitigate the Gundy case, because Justice Alito said, that the PFRs were dear to his heart and that he was appalled that the court did not want to look at that, which that case was involved dismantlement of the administrative state, which is something that the conservatives would like to do. And therefore, this is them wanting to go back and give Alito and the new conservative majority a chance to dismantle the administrative state. The only problem is they're not going to, because that wasn't the issue in Gundy. The issue was the administrative state. And now, when they get a clean case to dismantle the administrative state, I'll be very surprised if they would grant cert. And if they did grant cert, they would not dismantle the administrative state. But anyway, that's my opinion.
I gotcha. Shall we move right along then?
Absolutely. We got another case to talk about, don't we?
We do. We have the one that I've read multiple times. And it was like, you people. Put this case in from the Supreme Court named Shin versus Martinez. I did read it over twice, and I'm really irritated, and I can't wait to hear your mumbo-jumbo about how this is a reasonable decision. Let me set it up for you. According to the article, almost 4 years after a federal judge overturned Barry Jones's 1995 conviction, the U.S. Supreme Court invalidated the order directing Arizona to release and or retry Jones and reinstated his death sentence. The ruling put Jones on a path to execution in a state that just restarted its death machinery. Yay! Despite significant evidence that he is innocent. What is going on here?
Well, the case you're referring to was a 6-3 decision in Shin versus Martinez-Ramirez. And the decision was authored by Justice Clarence Thomas, who wrote that Jones and David Martinez-Ramirez should not be allowed to present new evidence in federal court showing that they had received ineffective assistance of counsel at trial. In Jones's case, the evidence dismantled the state's original theory of the crime. This is what prompted U.S. District Judge Timothy Burgess to vacate his conviction, and that name sounds familiar. If not for the failures of Jones' attorneys, Burgess wrote in 2018, jurors likely would have convicted him of only the crimes for which he was charged and previously convicted. That would not have convicted him of any of the crimes which he was charged and previously convicted.
Well, so the Supreme Court's May 23rd ruling renders this evidence and Burgess's core findings, which were twice upheld by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, moot. The majority agreed with Arizona's contention that under the 1996 Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, or EDPA, which sharply limits federal appeals, the hearing in Jones's case should never have taken place. In our dual sovereign system, federal courts must afford unwavering respect to trials in state courts. Justice Thomas wrote, federal courts lack the competence and authority to relitigate a state's criminal case. What does this mean when he said that the federal court lacks the competence and authority to relitigate?
I'm not really sure what he meant on the competence part, but on the issue of authority, he's referring to the severe restraints imposed by the AEDPA of 1996. Under AEDPA, the federal courts must defer to state court to the state court of conviction regarding most issues. The state courts are the final authority on the conviction unless one can show that the state court's decision is contrary to U.S. Supreme Court precedent. Nothing below U.S. Supreme Court precedent in the federal court system matters. According to this article that we're poaching from, the decision is a devastating blow to Jones, who has always insisted on his innocence. But it also slams the courthouse door on countless incarcerated people whose lawyers failed them at trial. Quote, the court's decision will leave many people who were convicted in violation of the Sixth Amendment to face incarceration or even execution without any meaningful chance to vindicate their right to counsel, Justice Sotomayor wrote in a dissent joined by Justice Stephen Breyer and Elena Kagan, the usual bastion of liberals.
I was going to say, aren't those all the liberal pointy heads there that you just called off?
Yes, those are the liberals who we need to get rid of on the court.
Of course, of course. Justice Sotomayor described Thomas's opinion as perverse and illogical, in part because it eviscerates the court's own 2012 ruling in Martinez versus Ryan, another case out of Arizona. Yeah, but you know what, Larry? Thomas doesn't really care about stare decisis, so anything that happened in the past doesn't matter in today's world. That decision created a much-needed remedy for defendants who received poor representation both at trial and in state post-conviction proceedings. Under the stringent rules governing federal appeals, a defendant who fails to challenge their trial lawyer's performance in state court is forbidden from bringing that evidence into federal court. But Martinez created an exception. It held that if the failure to develop such evidence in state court was due to a post-conviction lawyer's own ineffectiveness, the defendant should be excused and allowed to bring an ineffective assistance of claim in federal court. Isn't this reasonable?
Well, the ruling in Martinez versus Ryan was narrow, limited to those with substantial claims of a poor lawyering, which is difficult to prove. But it did. It offered a possible path of relief, but not a guarantee. Still, it was a rare lifeline to people on death row, many of whom have been represented by lawyers who were overworked and underpaid and often even unqualified. It is noteworthy that the 7-2 majority in 2012 included Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito, neither of whom raised any concerns this time about how the decision might be reconciled with AEDPA's procedural hurdles. So basically, they just threw out 10 years worth of precedent because it's inconvenient.
I see. It is interesting that both justices joined Thomas in weaponizing AEDPA to gut the 10-year-old ruling, an emblem of the court's newly aggressive indifference to its own legal precedent. Law professor Leah Littman, an expert on AEDPA and constitutional law, compared the decision to the leak draft opinion in Dobbs versus Mississippi, which stands to overturn Roe versus Wade. Both she wrote in an article for Slate, make clear that the court's conservative supermajority is hell-bent on smashing and grabbing precedent and constitutional rights, no matter the consequences.
No,
Do you want me to?
That's just.
I can give you a little bit of background.
You're just making this up. Go ahead.
I said. So Jones was sent to death row for rape and murder of his girlfriend's 4-year-old child, Rachel Gray. The child arrived at the Tucson hospital early in the morning on May 2nd, 1994, and was declared dead on arrival. An autopsy showed a blow to her abdomen, which ruptured her small intestine, developing into a fatal cause of peritonitis. Investigators seized on Jones without considering how or when the child sustained the injury. At trial, prosecutors relied on circumstantial evidence and dubious forensic testimony to convince jurors that Jones had repeatedly assaulted Rachel the day before she died. His trial attorneys called no witnesses at the guilt phase aside from his 12-year-old daughter. That doesn't sound like much of a trial, though, Larry, does it?
Well, no, it doesn't. Jones' case seemed like the perfect example of what the Martinez ruling was designed to address. I mean, what would you say? But not only had his trial lawyers failed to investigate the medical evidence that provided the basis for this conviction, but his post-conviction attorney also failed to do the same. At Jones' evidentiary hearing that was given to him in federal court, medical experts debunked the narrow time frame during which the state claimed that Jones had assaulted Rachel, showing that her fatal injury could not have developed so quickly. A slew of additional witnesses shed light on the shocking investigative failures of the Pima County Sheriff's Department. But according to the Supreme Court, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, clearly. But in Thomas's view, this evidentiary hearing was nothing more than an improper burden imposed on the states by the Martinez decision. The sprawling 7-day hearing included testimony from no fewer than 10 witnesses, including defense trial counsel, defense post-conviction counsel, the lead investigating detective, 3 forensic pathologists, and more, he wrote. The hearing covered virtually every disputed issue in the case, including the timing of Rachel Gray's injuries and her cause of death. This wholesale relitigation of Jones's guilt is plainly not what Martinez envisioned, according to Justice Thomas. This is not right, Larry, I don't think.
Well, I agree, but in her dissent, Sotomayor pointed out what should have been obvious, the court that handed down the Martinez ruling just a decade ago. Such a thorough hearing was necessary only because trial counsel failed to present that evidence during the guilt phase of Jones's capital case, she wrote. The district court hearing, this is the federal district court hearing, that when you exhaust everything in state court, hearing was wide-ranging precisely because of the breakdown in the adversarial system in the Jones case was so egregious. That was the justice saying that, not me. The notion that Jones' hearing was misapplication of Martinez only really made sense to those who believe that the ruling should be to remedy on paper alone, meaning that it's not a real remedy. This had been at the heart of Arizona's argument for years. Prosecutors insisted that even if Martinez allowed Jones to use new evidence to bring forth the claim of trial lawyers had been effective, he was not actually allowed that evidence to use that evidence to prove it. you have to admit this is funny.
No, it is not funny, Larry. I won't use those words. One question. Let me ask you this real quick from chat. It says, serious question. Are we overly focused on the court in this case and not the change in the law that set it up?
Well, we're focusing on both. There is the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act that was passed by a conservative Congress and signed by President Clinton in 1996. But this is precisely what courts exist to do, is to say, Congress, you got that wrong. You cannot deny people an opportunity to bring in evidence of their innocence. That is not within your purview to do that. The court could have done that. They chose not to.
I gotcha. Okay. Well, on the day after the Supreme Court's ruling, Jones's longtime attorney, Arizona Assistant Federal Defender Kerry Sandman, was still grappling with what had happened. Although he'd swiftly assembled his legal team to discuss next steps, it would take another day for him to bring himself to read the decision. At 70, Sandman had hoped to welcome Jones to the outside world as one of the final capstones to a long legal career. Instead, he went to see Jones at the Arizona Penitentiary, where he remains with no clear way out. Wow, that is really bad. That's awful.
The court's decision fulfilled Sandman's worst fears. There was no reason to take the case, meaning the Supreme Court, unless they were going to basically neuter Martinez, he said. After argument in December, Sandman echoed what legal observers were saying. The justices had asked all the right questions, but in the end, they made the ruling more cruel. The majority's decision will condemn many wrongful imprisonment or worse, death, Sandman said, all in the name of states' rights.
Do you think there's any hope for him going forward?
Well, the Pima County Attorney's Office, which is home to the conviction, they have a sentencing integrity unit. That integrity unit has repeatedly sidestepped inquiries as to when the office might reinvestigate the conviction. In an email last year, this is quoted from the article, Jack Chin wrote from the Pima County Attorney's Office that he has a general policy against the death penalty in all capital sentences, which are in our jurisdiction and responsibility, will be looked at closely and carefully. But he had not spent a great deal of time looking at Jones's cases. But after the Supreme Court's ruling, Chin wrote that the Conviction Integrity Unit has no plans to revisit the case.
Yikes. In the meantime, Jones is starting to see neighbors marched to the execution chamber. After an eight-year hiatus on executions, the state of Arizona killed 66-year-old Clarence Dixon by lethal injection earlier this month, struggling for 25 minutes to find a vein. Next month, Arizona plans to execute another man convicted in Tucson who insists upon his innocence. In an email shared by Sandman, Jones wrote that he was still processing the news about the Supreme Court ruling. Putting on a brave face, but underneath I am scared as I have ever been, he wrote. If they can put me back on death row, and they did, then there ain't a doubt in my mind that they could justify killing an innocent man. That's a really dark way to end that whole thing.
It absolutely is, and I'd just like to expand a little bit on what I said just a moment ago. The court is the only thing that can save us from this. You cannot repeal the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act. I mean, our audience, unless you were living in a cave when the confirmation process just took place and how much a judge got vilified, can you imagine if there were should be a proposal to amend the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act to make it easier to relitigate death sentences and convictions? To the whole basis for the Congress passing that was because they wanted to put an end to federal intervention and had let the states run their own courts. Try to sell that politically. You're living in a dream world. You haven't learned anything from the years of this podcast if you actually believe that we can fix this through a political process. We needed the court to take a firm stand and say, no, Congress, you cannot deprive people of introducing new evidence. If their attorneys botched it, the court is the equalizer for incompetent representation. That's what the court should have done, and that's what the court failed to do, and that's what the court can do, because the legislative process is not going to be able to fix this.
Lovely. Oh boy. All right. Yeah, I don't have anything else that I want to bring up about this one, Larry, other than that I read it twice and all your mumbo jumbo.
Well, I'm sad, but it's the law. It's a 6-3 ruling.
Yeah. Okay. We have converging agendas on covering this next piece, whereas I was fortunate to talk to the author of this article a couple of days ago. Was it yesterday? It may have been yesterday. Emily Horowitz wrote an article called The Real Monsters. And what I want to do is, the reason why she wanted to reach out and talk to me was that she interviewed a whole bunch of people. And so I'm making a plea to you, if you are one of the people that was interviewed by her, and you have not made yourself known to us in some form or fashion, and you are one of the people that I know there are a lot of people that are scared to come out of the woodwork, but please reach out and say hi. One of the reasons why we do this is to give some ray of hope or some reality and all that to people that are out there on the registry. We would certainly like to have more of you, but many people that she interviewed referenced this show as being the ray of light in the dark, dismal world of what the registry is. And it gave me a little bit of a little shot in the arm of some inspiration that there are a bunch of people out there that really appreciate the work that we're doing here. And so if you are one of those people, feel free to shoot an email over to registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And by all means, try to figure out how you can live. It sounds like so many people are just like, they're scared to death of their own shadow. And I really hope that you can find a way to start chipping away at that and start trying to live. Because I still think that even with all the horrible conditions that you can go live a life. I believe this. Anyway, you had a different agenda.
Well, if we're talking about the same article, the one I'm talking about is ones where she says sex offender registers don't make us any safer. Abolishing them would. I've paid particular attention to the final paragraph where she says public and political support for registries remains high. There's little evidence that attitudes have been impacted by a growing body of research showing that public registration, community notification, residence restrictions do not decrease the incidence of sexual offense, of sexual offenses. Well, I've been saying that for the years we've been live on this podcast, and I don't have that fancy degree, she says. So now that you've heard it from a researcher who has that fancy degree, take my word for it. The public overwhelmingly supports registration. And that's what we have to change if we're going to win this through the political process. We're not going to be able to win it through the courts. The courts cannot outlaw registration because the mere act of registering people is not unconstitutional. It can be, but just merely having a registry is not unconstitutional. If we're going to abolish the registry, we're going to have to do it by changing people's minds. And that, we have barely scratched the surface. Don't take my word for it. Take Emily's word for it.
Alrighty then. Well, again, so please figure out how to live, number one. Two, share this with all of your friends, family, everyone, so we can boost our numbers and spread our reach even farther. And come out of the woodwork and let me know that you're out there and say hi sometime. Especially at the conference, which is, 2 weeks away. Come say hi at the conference. I'll be the guy running the cameras and all the tech and looking very, very scraggly and delirious. Do you want to talk about your latest girlfriend picture, Larry, that no one guessed?
I'm very disappointed in this audience. We have such a sophisticated and well-educated, knowledgeable audience. And I showed you a photograph that should have been instantaneously recognizable by hundreds of people, and no one said congratulations. So we're going to show it again today for my September wedding. And if someone doesn't tell me who my fiance is... I'm not September coming back wedding, to this huh? program next week. September
oh,
wedding,
okay.
Yes.
Do I need to send that Uber to take you to the bridge?
That might be a good idea. So let's see her picture one more time. There she is. So
it's up there. I have no idea who this is. I mean, even though you told me and I, like, quote unquote, no. I, like, what did you even see her on to have a picture of this person? Give us a little bit of a clue.
Well, I can't do that.
So no clue at all?
Well, all she's right. very prominent.
And you just get to guess.
And she's very prominent. She has a show that dates back to the 1960s. Of course, she hasn't hosted it for all continuously, but yeah, the show itself dates back to, I think, the 1960s.
What is it? Judy Woodruff from the NPR PBS NewsHour?
No, that's not Judy.
Okay, I'm just checking. And tell me what you want to do about the Who's That Speaker. Do you want me to play what I played?
Yes, because we actually had a winner.
All right, we had a winner. Boy, and which one? Which one is that one? Is that Why I'm Here? No, that's not Why I'm Here.
The one you played was I failed to see what purpose that would serve.
Oh, okay, that one. All right, hang on.
I failed to see what purpose that would serve.
All right, that one. And who got it?
Well, it was posted on YouTube. And the person speaking that was actor Gregory Peck. And the person didn't name the actor, but they did name where Gregory Peck acted in To Kill a Mockingbird. And he was playing the role of Atticus Finch.
Oh.
And that is precisely the voice that he was hearing. It was from 1963, I believe, To Kill a Mockingbird. And that was the same voice. So congratulations. We need to have that person on our team to find voices that no one will recognize because he had to dig deep to figure that out.
Gotcha. All right. Is there anything else? We're at about minus 5 minutes for all my technical problems, but we're at about 1:08, I think, in time.
Awesome. Let's shut her down and plan to be here at the same time next week for
very good.
Hopefully I'll have my extra.
I hope so. What your extra what?
My episode regarding the economy.
Oh, I gotcha. That extra. So yeah, if you want to hear that extra and some of the other ones that we've done or all of the other ones that we've done, you can go over to patreon.com and support us over there and you will get the extras that we release for $1 a month even. Otherwise, you can find the show notes over at registrymatters.co or fypeducation.org is where the transcripts get posted. and leave voicemail at 747-227-4477. And registrymatterscast@gmail.com, like I've said. And of course, like I said a minute ago, patreon.com/registrymatters. I think that is everything that we have for the evening, Larry. And I hope all goes well for you the rest of the weekend. And otherwise, I will talk to you very soon.
Good night.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.